Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, we begin our special series, Escaping the Cage, Identity, Multiculturalism, and Writing, a series drawn from Bookworm interviews old and new. What is identity in literature? How do writers create an identity? Is identity politics a creative or destructive force? What is the status of multiculturalism right now? These are the questions I have asked the more than 25 writers you'll be hearing in the coming weeks. Today's show is an overview of the series, and you'll hear Maya Angelou, Susan Sontag, Russell Banks, and Camille Paglia, among others. In 1969, when Maya Angelou wrote, "I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings," she could not have known how wide the cage door would open, nor could she have known the impact her voice would make on our culture. Now, I've seen you at book fairs and other events, literally look at young men who are trying to jar you or rile you and say,
"That won't do."
And you smile.
Of course.
Now, these people, in their way, are asserting identities. And they want themselves to be known as tough or, you know, the two generations after we be cool. Now, when you have a culture that has defined itself through the idea, on the one hand, of success, how successful are you? And on the other hand, viciousness, how tough are you? And these are neither of them necessarily spiritual values, although both of them may be the values that make a writer's name. Success has never hurt, and viciousness has never been far away from the pen and the page. But how do you teach a generation to incur values other than the ones that are prevalent, admired, desired, and imitated?
I don't even know if admired or desired. I think imitated, because it may give identity, but not necessarily admired. I did a movie. I was did a cameo in a movie called Poetic Justice, John Singleton's movie, and with Miss Janet Jackson. And they used my poetry, exclusively. And then Mr. Singleton asked me to come out to California and do a 1 week, a cameo. I said yes. While I was there, they were shooting in Griffith Park here in Los Angeles. And there were about 200 extras at a picnic. And I noticed that there was one fellow who cursed. Woo! I mean, blue streaks, you could see the blue up over his head. He was just using every kind of vulgarity. I just saw it. And he saw me and didn't stop. Now, usually white, black, Latino, any young man or woman who's acting up, when they see me, they just stop somehow. He didn't. About the third day, this same young man was, maybe the second day, cursing again, and another young man began cursing with him, and the two of them were about to get into it, and all the extras ran, because I guess they were thinking of random shootings or something. And then the one black man went up to the two young men, and I just went up. So I took one of them, and I said, "Excuse me, may I speak to you?" He said, "I wouldn't give up." I said, "I understand that. If these mother," I said, "Gotcha, I understand you. But let me speak to you. I beg you, please. Finally, calm down. And I ask, when is the last time anyone told you how important you are? Did you know that people stood on the auction block so that you could be here today? Some people stood on slave ship decks and were washed down like dogs and pigs so that you could be here today. I said, do you know we have no one but you? I just talked to him, and all of a sudden the tears came out of his eyes. And I turned him around, and I walked down a little ravine and kept his back to the people because they started coming back out. I didn't have a Kleenex, so I took my hands and wiped his face. And we turned around and came back. And when I got to my trailer, Miss Janet Jackson came. She said, Dr. Angelo, I don't believe you spoke to Tupac Shakur. So about 2 months later, I received a letter from Tupac Shakur's mother saying, thank you so much. I heard of what you did for my son. He phoned her right as soon as I finished talking to him. And she said, you may have saved his life. And then, of course, he was killed. People need to be talked to, and talked to like human beings, and talked to with love, not just judgment. And talked to because I know that they are going to give me a tomorrow, and whatever they give me, I deserve, in direct relation to how I speak to them.
That was Dr. Maya Angelou. And this is novelist Russell Banks, most recently the author of The Darling.
From the beginning, or at least early on in my writing life, I began to locate myself in what I think of as borderlands. I live on the borders, literally, border between Canada and the United States, and I've spent most of my adult life either on the border between Florida and the Caribbean or the northern border of the United States in a very literal and physical sense. But I've always felt as though I was on the borders of identity between other human beings, between men and women, between white people and black people, between Americans and non-Americans, between adults and children. In a sense, this is the location of my imagination. And I've mapped it out over the, now what, 40 years or more of writing. I've mapped out a territory in a way that is on the borders. I'm most comfortable there. I think I'm most intelligent there. I feel most authentic there in a paradoxical way than when I have one locatable identity, let's say as a white male American man from the northeastern United States. I don't feel comfortable with one identity. I feel authentic and comfortable when I'm moving between identities.
Now, at the same time as there is the culture of literature, which grows and accretes, and not just in each writer's work, but in a nation's literature, there is the cultural climate in which we live that has been practically howling at writers to create hegemonies. You and Joyce Carol Oates in particular are the primary, it seems to me, white American violators of that insistence that we stay in a personal neighborhood. And I want to ask you to talk to me about that. I don't even know the question that informs it. But it does seem to me that if there were a writer's bill of rights, you would be demanding the right to enter other existences that are telling you, we own these, you stay home.
Yeah, the territoriality of identity politics, which seems to me not just wrong-headed, but dangerous, and for various reasons. I mean, you have to ask, who does it serve? Follow the money, that sort of thing.
Who does it serve?
Well, hegemony of identity of any kind serves marketing principles, basically. It's niche marketing. There's an economic use for it. There's a political use for it. You can target those voters with one speech. You know exactly how to do it. You can target the other voters with another speech, and you can bring them into your party. So I think, yeah, political and economic. And I think that writers themselves are often misled by it and manipulated by it, by identity politics, and they end up serving it.
That was Russell Banks. This is novelist and essayist, the late and deeply missed Susan Sontag.
I never like to talk about my work in relation to my life, because I don't see it that way. I think it's not helpful for me to see it that way. It's not, and it's not more important. I'm not making a decision based on grounds of utility. It just doesn't come naturally to me. I don't think of the work as reflecting me any more than, more generally speaking, I think that I write to express myself. I don't think I'm writing to express myself or to define myself. I think of those as low, ignoble motives. Now, of course, I'm sure I do express myself in my writing, and I'm sure I do define myself in my writing, but that's not the point, the purpose, the intention, the goal. If it were, it feels to me I would be involved in a much more limiting and rather lowering project. I wouldn't have the inner freedom to do whatever I do if I thought that I was expressing myself or that I was talking about the choices that I've made. If the work were chapters in an autobiography, and yet, Michael, of course I understand that it could look like that from the outside. So I think what I would want to start with is with trying to explain, or really to formulate for myself, because I don't know if it's entirely clear to me either, that my work comes out of a tension or contradiction between what it might look like and what maybe it is, and the way I experience it, and the way I keep it going. It's true that as a person, I am very committed to, by temperament, the project of self-improvement, of self-transformation, of self-reinvention, of self-transcendence. But I think of the essays, these essays and this thinking in public as being about it and not about me. It doesn't seem to me to be about me. It seems much more objective, even though I know from the outside it can't look that like that. And it is, and it must be subjective, but I don't feel that that's true. I don't feel that it's a vehicle of my of me, of my ego, or of my search for self-expression. And I don't feel I'm searching at all for self-expression. Maybe the reason that I see it this way, Michael, is because I'm a fanatic, self-tormenting rewriter. I deeply envy people who can pretty much get it right. I'm talking about the language, the level of the language, the eloquence, not just the ideas. Pretty much the first time around in the early draft, and then they kind of fix it up. My essays, much more than my fiction, go through many, many, many drafts, and in the course of which I change my mind. I have new ideas. I sometimes end up thinking quite the opposite from what I started out with. I have to think in stages, and in some funny way, I think the essays are a lot smarter than I am. I mean, I don't think I'm as smart in real life, if I can put it so stupidly, as the essays, in the sense that I can't come up with this kind of stuff just like that at the drop of a hat.
That was Susan Sontag. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and the first show of our special series, Escaping the Cage, Identity, Multiculturalism, and Writing. I spoke with novelist Sandra Cisneros about what we should and should not be reading.
People don't realize that about us, that we read everything all over the world, whether it's Nabokov or Duras or Pavese. You know, the whole world is what we're reading. We feel, especially as writers of color, sometimes you feel a little bit guilty about what you're reading. You're supposed to read this or you're supposed to read that. But I think our hearts really have their own appetite for what we need, and that becomes our curriculum.
Here is New Yorker cartoonist and graphic novelist Art Spiegelman.
Inevitably, one represents oneself in the work. Whether one inserts oneself overtly or not is an aesthetic choice. But the choice of language, the choice of what is being seen, is all coming from somewhere. It's why reading a book is climbing into somebody's head.
This is Cynthia Ozick, whose most recent novel is Heir to the Glimmering World.
Identity comes from home and from parents and from grandparents. I'm uncomfortable with the word identity. It's a word that has become more and more linked with the word ethnic, which it seems to me is a sociologist's invention producing fake and demeaning splintering. Mm. The word is Greek in origin and refers to pagans, and if you look it up, it means persons who are neither Jewish nor Christian. And I don't think anybody in this country wants to be an ethnic.
I'm talking to Stephen Greenblatt, professor at Harvard and recent author of Will and the World, How Shakespeare Became Shakespeare. And he has been one of the most well-admired members of a group of cultural theorists who've transformed, in a sense, the use of history in literary analysis. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about how our sense of history, identity, authenticity even, all of the terms that once were fairly stable in literary studies, how and why they've been altered in our time. And I thought I'd ask you what it is that has brought what is called sometimes contemptuously, sometimes honestly, identity politics to the fore in so much education.
To some extent, identity politics has come to the fore in education with an emphasis not on identity but on politics. It's good politics, identity politics. It enabled people to get departments created in universities that didn't exist, to get curricula organized that hadn't been organized before. It's a way of achieving certain kind of space in academic power. And it's been done so, in my view, in interesting and sometimes less interesting ways, but as a way of playing a certain game based really roughly, rather crudely, on a 19th century game of national identity. But now it's not national identity, but it's Chicano nation or gay nation or women's nation, as it were. But it's basically a 19th century national idea that was very useful. The trouble with it is that the other side of the genuinely exciting things that it has done admirable things, is that it's hardened in absurd ways the first part, the identity part, and it's created a kind of often a trap for people in that part. That is to say, what was once actually fluid and complicated suddenly, for the purposes of establishing a certain claim over territory, gets narrowed and hardened, as if everyone had to have the same format, the same identity. It doesn't work that way.
That was Stephen Greenblatt. Literary critic Camille Paglia's most recent book is Break, Blow, Burn.
Do you think that art itself has had the opportunity to thrive under the realm of identity politics?
No. Identity politics, since the 70s, has been the ruination of any kind of original American art. Art just comes with these little tags, that identifies it as coming from an ethnic, a certain ethnic group or a racial group or a certain gender, etc. So all these tags, which supposedly were about giving voice to the silenced, have turned out to be very flattening and reductive. I do not see any great feminist poetry. I don't see it having emerged. I think that the last great poem by a woman before Woodstock, Joni Mitchell's Woodstock, was, for example, Sylvia Plath's Daddy. It's a tremendous expression of defiance to masculine authority, but it precedes the women's movement. Okay, the moment the women's movement was out there with its pre-programmed topics, okay, and its attitudes and its postures, we've gotten a raft of cliches. The anthologies and college classes have turned themselves over to a certain kind of facile tokenism and quota system, so that one has to have a certain number of poems by women, a certain number of poems by gays, a certain number of poems by Chinese people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, without any notion of quality. Now, on the one hand, I favor this, the broadening, certainly, of the traditional canon. I am an admirer of Leslie Fiedler, who was a pioneer in this area and who was asking for this multiculturalism in criticism from the late 1940s on. So I do believe that this identity politics is part of the revolution of the 1960s, and it's at its best is admirable. But unfortunately, it has become a kind of a knee-jerk, formula-driven style that has ended in a kind of desiccation of art making, as well in a kind of paralysis of responsiveness to art among the general audience.
That was Camille Paglia. In his new novel, I Am Charlotte Simmons, novelist Tom Wolfe addresses what neuroscientists are telling us about human identity.
I simply can't conceive of not being me. I think most of us can't conceive of that. Well, the neuroscientific argument is, nevertheless, you aren't you. You are a mechanism. There is no ghost in the machine who's directing the activities and giving you free will. I mean, so the bottom line is you don't have free will. You think you're making decisions yourself, and you're not. And you are the rock that has been thrown and given consciousness in midair, and now thinks it has free will and can come up with a fabulously logical, highly rational arguments as to why you've chosen this direction on your own, even though you're just a trajectory. This, I believe, is gradually becoming the human being's conception of itself.
I'm speaking to David Mitchell, the author most recently of the novel Cloud Atlas, which is published in paperback. To what extent do you feel that what you write is dependent on who you are and where you come from?
I'd like to answer your question by positing a grand metaphor on... I've thought of it in terms of personality, but I think it works for identity as well. The metaphor is that identity is a grand parliament in a representative democracy. This parliament, let's take the British model, it has 650 seats. There is a centrist party. There are parties to the left, parties to the right. There are lunatic fringes. There are racists. There are homophobes in this parliament, hopefully in very small numbers, but they are there. In the same way that in such a parliament in real life, the centrist party controls most of the decision-making apparatus. It calls the shots. On the whole, a sort of the centrist party of the personality, the generally reasonable, the generally moderate, the generally law-abiding aspects of us dictate how we will act. We nonetheless have voices and give voices too, and I think modern psychiatry is useful in terms of warning against what happens if we try and bar these more extreme members of the parliament of identity from at least having a voice. We also have these more extreme voices in us, and we give vent to them. But hopefully they don't dictate our actions most of the time.
How well do you feel that a writer needs to know the members of the fringe party that constitute him?
I feel very strongly that we need to know them very well. They are our bread and butter. If we wish to write a character with extreme views, if we have a narrator who is not of the ruling party, then we need to be able to hear these voices and reconstruct them in words on the page.
That was David Mitchell, author of Cloud Atlas. As our special series, Escaping the Cage, Identity, Multiculturalism, and Writing, continues in the coming weeks, we'll be hearing an entire parliament of voices, including Norman Mailer, E.L. Doctorow, Rita Dove, Edward P. Jones, Alice Walker, James McCourt, Edmund White, Alan Hollinghurst, Susan Choi, Maxine Hong Kingston, Joan Didion, and Toni Morrison. We'll discuss the issues of identity with African-American writers, Asian-American writers, Jewish writers, gay writers. The producers of Escaping the Cage are Michael Silverblatt, Melinda Siegel, and Alan Howard. The engineer is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.